Dame Nellie Melba. She's a legend of Australian singing. Well, she was a legend. I'm not sure many of us have heard of her now. Yeah, and I know what you're thinking, that she doesn't deserve to be a legend if this is a sample of her best work. Well, it isn't. This is what's called a distance test. It was made back in 1910 when the science of sound recording wasn't what it is today. It's a kind of sound check in which the audio engineer, I doubt they were called that back then, is trying to work out how far Dame Nellie should stand from the microphone. Too close and the sound will distort. Too far away and Dame Nellie might be too faint, her voice lost in the hisses and hums. History is a kind of distance test. It's an attempt to see and hear how far we are from the past and how close we can get to it. Actually, it's not just a single attempt, but many, each one embodying an ideal about the past. Because we all have an opinion about the past, about what it is and what it means. Take Leo Colston, the narrator of L.P. Hartley's novel, The Go-Between. The past, Leo says, is a foreign country. They do things differently there. Is the past really a foreign country? Hello and welcome to Foreign Correspondence, an experimental podcast that explores this very question. In this podcast, I set out to see if reading letters to editors from century-old newspapers makes the past feel more present. Not to me, a student of history, but to so-called ordinary people, adults and children whose relationship with the past is personal and non-professional. By recording strangers I meet on the street, people who agree to read an old letter aloud and to reflect on the experience, I hope to make history, a kind of live and living history that is at once both personal and public. Will the voices of the letter writers and of their modern-day readers come through loud and clear, or will they be lost in the hisses and hums?
My name's Jarrell from Western Australia.
Are you generally interested in history?
I have been interested in some parts of it. Some parts of it make me pretty upset.
Thursday, September the 8th, 1921. All the letters featured in this podcast appeared in newspapers on that day a century ago. It's not a special date in Australian history, but that's partly the point. Back then, Billy Hughes was Prime Minister and George V was King. Australians were still feeling the effects of the war and the Spanish flu pandemic. Edith Cowan had become the first woman to be elected to an Australian parliament. The Commonwealth Health Department had just been established, and the Cadbury chocolate factory was about to open in Claremont, Tasmania. 63 people died in Brisbane during an outbreak of the bubonic plague.
Lincoln, and I'm also from Western Australia.
And are you generally interested in history?
Yeah, I am, although I probably don't put as much time into it as I should. Pretty much popular history. Yeah. I feel like I don't have much of a understanding of, modern history. It's something I didn't really cover in high school.
Also making the news on that day was Dame Nellie Melba, who had just returned, again, to Australia. Dame Melba's homecoming concert, a report in Table Talk magazine begins, a memorable occasion.
I'm Robin, I'm from Hobart.
Are you generally interested in history?
Yes.
You are?
Yes.
Okay, and what forms of history do you...
Looking a lot at the ancestors and how the Aboriginals settled Tasmania, so right back.
But century-old newspapers did much more than report the doings of celebrities, politicians and sportsmen. Like the internet today, newspapers acted as an outlet for all sorts of information, including some that was personal. This reflected the local status of newspapers. Most were closely associated with a town or city, but also the fact that, word of mouth aside, periodicals were the only regular source of information then available to Australians. In 1921, radio was still a few years away. Amongst the articles and advertisements, we find, for example, personal news items, such as this one. printed in the All About People section of the Gundagai Independent and Pastoral, Agricultural and Mining Advocate on September the 8th, 1921. Mr. and Mrs. Tom Lloyd of Adelong are having a trying time with their two children. Both have contracted pneumonia and have been very low for the last few days. Mrs. Lloyd is watching her children very closely, nursing them day and night. She's completely worn out, and assistance cannot be got owing to so much sickness prevailing.
It's Gustavo, so it's a good Argentinian name, but yeah. I actually live in Blackmans Bay. I'm always interested. Yeah. I think I've always been curious about history, yep. Favourite subject at high school and so on. I just don't think there's enough out there, really. I mean, yeah. we don't really, look into it.
Letters, too, are a feature of these century-old newspapers, as they have been throughout the history of the medium. In the absence of any other form of social media, letters to the editor are, in fact, one of the few places we encounter the experiences and opinions of ordinary men, women and children from the past. Yes, we have books from that era, but they tend to be written by educated elites. Which is not to say that in these letters we hear history straight from the horse's mouth. Letters to the editor are mediated by newspaper staff, by yet more educated elites. Inevitably, this influences what letter writers say and how they say it. It determines what gets printed and what doesn't. Mind you, it's not that these letters aren't true, it's just that they're not the whole truth. Letters to the editor printed in Australian newspapers 100 years ago fall into a few different categories. There are the letters about local issues, about council elections, farmers and footpaths. There are the letters about individual issues, about people's pet peeves, non-capsizable rowboats, anyone? And then there are letters about wider issues, about matters that tend to transcend time and space, like human rights. In a letter printed in the Sydney Morning Herald, Cosmopolite decries the treatment of native Fijians in their homeland, adding that the calm insolence of the white race, spoken of by your correspondent, is better seen in Australia than anywhere. The natives find their land confiscated, they are interned, and a blanket is supplied annually, although it is stated that Australia contains more blacks than the whole of the Fijian group. Other letters are concerned with the lives of Australian women.
It's a letter from a newspaper, Australian Worker, that's called Tired Mothers. Dear Madam, at one time I was one of your tired mothers and was tired of life at 23. But now, thank God, with my boys earning, it is but the small country wage, I feel as if I'm just beginning to live. I have done washing and sewing, have often been up until midnight sewing for others, and I know what real hardship means. When I look back on those hard years of my young life, I wonder how I managed at all. I have 7 children and would not mind if there were a dozen. But why bring them into the world only to be cannon food? I would never agree to any of my boys going to fight for any country but Australia. For Australia, if need be, even her women would take up the rifle. Now this is a long letter, and I must close. Yeah, it's pretty haunting in places there, I gotta say. But also a bit patriotic towards the end there, which is pretty cool. It makes me think about my own mother. It makes me realize just how different life is today, I guess, above all, because it's a very different world that I've grown up in.
This is from the Brisbane Courier. The lot of a dairy woman. Sir, it is with wonder at how much overworked dairymen can find time to write such long letters that's been lately appearing in the Courier, and also how they've been acquired such a command of English as evidenced in some of the cases. We Australians pride ourselves on being free-loving people. One wonders, after reading the disclosures in the letter signed a dairy wife, sleepy little children hurried off to the milking shed, a rush of home to swallow a bit of breakfast, then hurry out to school. Very bad for the children's nerves. She's rushed off to someone's home to give birth to a child in an utterly exhausted condition, physically and mentally. She returns to her drudgery, the poor woman, to drudgery after a fortnight. It seems to me that their own sakes and even for their other children's, they should get together and discuss other ways and means of carrying on their industry. Oh my God! Nina in Westaway. I mean, to give birth, they'd be looking after cows, they'd be milking, making their own butter, cheese, everything, and you had to do it to survive.
The war and its aftermath feature in several letters. R.I. Jameson, for example, praises the efforts of Red Cross workers in a letter printed in the Sydney Morning Herald. "Sir," he writes, "quite early in the war, our only son was missing, and his mother asked the London Times if it would be possible for its Paris office to try and obtain news of him. A search of some weeks was made by one of the Times' Paris staff, and though it proved vain, it was the first attempt at what afterwards became an important department of Red Cross work." How to remember the fallen? Another letter deals with this question.
Rob, I live in Hobart. So I'm reading from the Mercury, Hobart, Tasmania, and the heading is "The War Memorial." To the editor of the Mercury, "Sir, as there is such a wide diversity of opinion as to what shape this should resume, might I suggest the following simple idea: that the monument would be erected just outside the town hall at the angle of Macquarie Street and Argyle Street, where there is plenty of room and the spot is at present rather uninteresting. I think the memorial should consist of a high pedestal surmounted by an angel in marble with outspread wings, holding aloft a crown, which would be illuminated with crimson electric lights. This monument would be seen daily by half the inhabitants of Hobart, and at night the effect of the crimson cross would be very fine and would even illuminate the harbour. This seems to be a very simple suggestion, could be carried out fairly calmly, would greatly beautify the busiest part of the city, and probably would not cost more than £5,000. Yours, etc., Lex." I'm not much into memorials, really. For me, it's like, oh, this is quaint. And I'm wondering if it actually took place. I don't know.
And then there's the perennial topic of money. "Dear sir," country resident writes in the Yass Courier, "I was in Yass the other day, the first time for some months, and was charged 2 shillings for a meal at an hotel. It was raised to this amount at the time of the war and drought, and when meat was at 1 shilling 6 pence per pound. Now meat is only half that price, and other things have gone down also. So why should the fare at the hotels remain up?" Two other letters give different perspectives.
From the Western Mail in Perth, Western Australia, Thursday the 8th of September 1921, so they would have just been in the Federation, although they're trying to break away from it. Parkville Appeal to the editor. "Sir, I am writing a little letter to tell you that a dear old dog called Jerry has collected over £100 for the wives of Parkville, and I think it would be a nice idea to buy him a collar with his name engraved on it, because he has done such a great deal for the poor little children who have no parents. I am enclosing a postal note for 1 shilling towards buying the collar, and I hope other children will send him some money also. I remain yours truly, Edna Wilkerson. Subscriptions to this fund should be sent to the Ugly Men's Association. They will be acknowledged through the Western Mail," on the editor.
So this is a letter from the Great Southern Advocate, Currumburra, Victoria, to the editor. "Dear Sir, as a visitor to the reservoir on Saturday, I was surprised to hear of the charge of 10 shillings per year imposed by the local water trust for a license to fish in the reservoir. The anglers should resent the idea of the trust making revenue out of the club members, of which have nothing to gain except to indulge in a fruitless effort on many occasions to secure their breakfast in these high-priced waters. If fish were plentiful, it would be a different matter. It costs members 2 shillings 6 pence to join, and if Saturday's haul is any indication of what to expect later, well, to my mind, the game is hardly worth the candle. The better way would be for the trust to charge the club, say, £5 for the season. Yours, etc., Schnapper. Because it's talking about clubs, which is something I've had experience with in the past, it's interesting to see, I guess, the politics around it, where people have their different opinions on how things should be run. And I'm no fisherman personally, but it's interesting to see, I guess, this person's take on how they're going about running the club.
Perhaps the most personal and appealing letters printed in century-old newspapers are written by kids. Some newspapers, the overtly religious ones especially, have whole sections devoted to young folk, in which children write about their everyday lives, and maternal figures with names like Gum Blossom and Aunt Patsy dispense advice and book recommendations while trying to connect and encourage their young readers. Little but great, as the motto of the Western Mail Silver Chain Club goes.
Angus, and I'm from Hobart, the Freeman's Journal, Sydney, New South Wales. My dear Gum Blossom, this is my first letter to you. I walk about 200 yards to school. I go to the Convent of Mercy in Hamilton. I'm in the fourth class and I have a very nice teacher. We have a soccer football for our own class and we play every morning, dinner time and after school in the evening. We have an hour and a half for lunch. Last time we played third class and beat them by 3-0. Our side was red and gold. I was full back and kicked for the goalkeeper. The third class team were yellow and gold. We started at 3 o'clock and finished at 5 o'clock. At half time we were 1 and at full time we were 3. I hope to see this letter in print. Dear Gumbleson, I remain yours truly, Adrian Alcock, aged 10 years. That was a very good experience. It's just nice to get some input from other people's lives. Well, it's kind of a bit the same. He plays sport, likes to talk about sport, and I like sport as well. But I have had like a football journal where I record my football games. Oh, I'd probably tell him about what sort of things I do and what I enjoy.
I'm Eliza and I'm from Hobart. I like to play some sports and like to do reading and like school a little.
Freeman's Journal, Sydney. Dear Gum Blossom, I look out for the Freeman every week and like reading the letters. The inspector has been here and little sister, Alistair, just started to school. She will be 6 years old next month. I like reading your chat and the poetry. It will soon be show time and I am going to the show. My mother might be going to the young show. There will be a special train run from here. Young is about 50 miles by rail from Barowa and 28 miles by road. We went for a long walk today. We will soon have plenty of nice green grass and flowers. I remain your found friend, Annie Brown.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
She reads the letters.
A little different to me.
I don't really read the letters every day. She walks like 8 miles from her house.
Yeah, pretty interesting.
Her grass will remain green.
Nice to have someone you don't really know and someone a bit different to you.
So, is Leo Colston right? Is the past a foreign country?
I guess more like this country, not like a foreign country, because it's still, I guess this is deeply Australian in some ways, but at the same time, just feels not like a different country, but honestly like a different time, I guess.
I think history is just continuous. Yeah. If we don't hear the stories from our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents, then we don't understand what's going on.
It's just fascinating for me to see how people were, what they said, what they did in the past, and yep. see the similarities now yep. and the differences. But my favourite quote is from Wittgenstein, who said that our future calls out and beckons us. And for most people, our future is our past. So I think that somehow we get run or dictated to by our history. And when we can notice our history and become aware of it, there's a chance of doing something different.
Perhaps the past, as a continent, is lost. Perhaps all that remains of it is an archipelago, a long string of islands. Like the lost links in a silver chain, our ancestors have been submerged by time, their voices drowned out. The voices in this podcast, an eerie amalgam of the old and the new, the dead and the living, are themselves weak and incomplete, as if emanating, dare I say it, from a distant land, from the foreign country that is perhaps both the past and the present. In December 1926, 5 years after the letters in this podcast were published, Dame Nellie Melba made one of her many final appearances on stage at the Royal Opera House in London. After the performance, she gave a farewell speech, in which her voice, at least, can be heard through the hiss and hum of history. I'd like to thank Jurel, Lincoln, Robin, Gustavo, and Rob, whose openness, generosity, and engagement made this podcast possible, and Dr. King for the nudge. Thanks also to Eliza for her insights and enthusiasm, and to Angus for his perceptions and piano playing. Thanks, as always, to Andrea. If you'd like more information about this podcast, visit my website, timintype.com/podcast. That's timintype.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.